Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. However,
we are going to have an industry pro with us later in the episode. This is a great opportunity for us to shift gears a little bit. When we originally envisioned this podcast, and we have a huge format document because we've been planning this for a while, we wanted to hit like really big business beats that happened that were in our wheelhouse and things that we could talk about. And this is a great opportunity for us to segue and transition into that format, because since we last spoke with you on an episode that was recorded on Wednesday night, it's currently Friday midday, there have been three fairly significant business beats that have popped up. Yep. And we're going to talk about those before we bring on Evakar from Glitch to talk to us about what she's doing. So the first thing that we wanted to talk about, GameStop announced its earnings for its fourth quarter, which ended February 2nd, 2020. So it covered the months of November, December, and January.
The holiday month, you mean?
Yeah, the holiday month. And we already knew that their holiday sales were really, really bad. They put out a release about that early in the calendar year.
They also
announced their full year earnings. It isn't great.
Okay, but how isn't it great? Because, I mean, let's think about where they were last year around this time. After the holiday in 2018, their sales were still, for the most part, depressed year over year.
Sure. And we were starting to see this, and this has been a generation-long decline for GameStop.
It has been, yes. As we move more and more into digital spaces, and we're talking more about having digital storefronts and digital marketplaces, and we're seeing companies like Ubisoft really... Ubisoft and EA are the big ones where they're really capitalizing on recurring digital revenue. Where's the room for a specialty retail store like GameStop?
And I think that that's GameStop's biggest problem. I think you've hit on it. This was a conversation they should have been having internally before the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 launched. And the reason for that is just to give everyone a quick refresher on what has changed from last generation to our current generation, which is almost over.
Oh my goodness, it really is almost
over.
It is.
We've gone through an entire cycle. This is like my first full cycle as someone in the industry, because I've been doing this for about a decade. You've been doing this for a decade.
Yeah.
I think that a couple things to talk about. I wrote about this on Game Informer back when I was there, that if you look at what things were like on the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3, there were a couple things that were problematic about their digital storefronts. Number one, you didn't always have day and date digital releases. So retail was still the primary vehicle for games that were released at retail, because not every game was.
Of course. And the other portion of the problem was that the physical versions of the games would go on sale, but the digital versions would stay full price.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just going on sale, you would see price drops, like full price drops happen at retail.
On the other end of the decay curve.
Right. And they would not happen on the digital. So on the digital side, so you might have a greatest hits game selling for $20 at all major retailers, and that includes GameStop, Best Buy, Target, Walmart, and all of the others, Toys R Us when it was still around.
It is still
around. It is still around in Canada. Long live Toys R Us. I was a Toys R Us kid, so...
Oh, pour one out for Toys R Us.
Exactly. Now, those games, even if they saw a full price drop at retail, they didn't see that drop. So when I wrote this piece for Game Informer, I said regular sales on digital storefronts that mirrored what was happening on Steam and other PC storefronts was absolutely required. And that happened. So you've got day and date digital, which you can play a game at midnight. Now GameStop used to do midnight releases for a ton of things, and they don't really.
Now it's only the biggest releases of the year. We just saw midnight releases for, what was it? It was Doom Eternal.
They were supposed to be. They ended up canceling.
Oh, that's right. But they normally do the biggest games of the year will still have their midnight releases.
And now you can just do it in your in your skivvies, right? You can just have the game preloaded on your system. You can
preload your game.
And right at midnight...
I'm sorry, like we did with Animal Crossing?
Like we did with Animal Crossing.
Are we talking about Animal Crossing some more? Can we talk about Animal Crossing?
We have three huge topics, and as much as I'd love to talk about Animal Crossing...
Mike, what's the price of turnips? No, I'm just kidding.
On my island? You don't want to visit my island. The Nook boys are super stingy today. So, you know, those are the two factors, I think, on the digital side that really change things. The other is storage space and, you know, being able to, like, we have in both of our office PlayStation and Xbox when we've got external drives. Do you have an external drive plugged in at your desk on your PlayStation?
On my PlayStation, I do. On my Xbox, I don't. I play the vast majority of my Xbox games on my PC these days.
There you go. So being able to expand that storage, day-and-date digital, preloading, discounts, really pushed people towards digital, and it left GameStop scrambling in a way that it shouldn't. Because these shouldn't have been surprises.
No, absolutely not. They should have been having these conversations internally, like you said, prior. As soon as they had the information, and I don't know if they did. I don't know how closely Sony and Microsoft guarded those secrets from retail partners and vendors. But if they had that kind of information, they should have been working toward a more hybrid model and finding that harmony between physical and digital instead of swallowing up ThinkGeek and then shutting them down.
And that is a perfect point where GameStop has really found strength in its collectible business, but it also killed a brand that had a huge amount of value. Now.
And cachet,
absolutely. So for the fourth quarter, GameStop's revenue was down $869 million. So we're creeping up on $1 billion of revenue lost during a quarter that represents the holiday. Now, GameStop will tell you that, oh, it's because it's the end of the cycle. And to some extent, they're not incorrect. However, if you go and look at the numbers, and you and this is not a perfect mapping because
no,
GameStop is global.
Yes.
And NPD is
America.
So, but if you look at those numbers, if you look at the percentage of drop and you look at, you know, NPD versus how much GameStop is dropping, and you can look at their sales mix, GameStop is underperforming the average. They're getting hurt more than everybody else on legacy hardware, which is become, well, hardware that is soon to become legacy.
Oof, man, you're just like, you're really just looking to bury the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4, huh?
Well, since the next generation is on one side more backwards compatible than anything we've ever seen. On the other side, mostly backwards compatible.
You know what?
I'm okay, like, burying it in Animal Crossing and growing a PlayStation tree and an Xbox tree.
That's a brilliant idea. Can we do that?
I don't know. We should try it.
We should try
it. So you bury your special edition Switch on your island and you tell me how it goes.
I don't want to do that.
You want a Switch tree?
I think I have a regular Switch.
Give me a Switch.
No, I have a regular Switch. I'll bury that one. I'll let you guys know if I can grow a Switch tree.
Nice. So their net income for the quarter was $21 million, positive. So they were in the black on net income on the quarter.
That's something.
That's an improvement from a loss last year, Q4, of $187.7 million.
That's definitely an improvement year over year, but the revenue, goodness.
Let's pull the camera back, though, because now we need to look at their full year. So this is fiscal year 2019, which ended on February 2nd, I believe, 2020. Revenue is down $1.8 billion.
Oh, that's taking one right to the heart.
Yeah, their net losses were $470.9 million in addition to the $673 million of losses they had last fiscal year. So in the past 2 years, GameStop has posted losses of more than $1 billion.
Wow. We were just talking about pouring one out for Toys R Us, Mike.
Yeah, pour one out for Blockbuster. I mean GameStop.
All right, well let's talk about some of the ways that GameStop has been trying to stop the bleeding.
Yes. So in 2019, they closed a net 321 stores. And if, you know, I joke about Blockbuster, right? But GameStop has followed the same path that Blockbuster has, where they overexpanded.
Yeah, absolutely.
They went for density. It was the Starbucks approach where, oh, I'm going to cross the street and go to a Starbucks after I just left a Starbucks.
Okay, but at the same time, we know that that's apples and oranges. Sure. Because Starbucks is always full. Like, it's right. Always got customers. There are always people there. And any stores that don't have a following of customers, they quickly shut down or they relocate.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that the location isn't good and there isn't enough demand for it. But, I mean, everybody needs their coffee.
Right.
Does everybody need their Funko Pops? They can go to Hot Topic.
If there is ever a Star Trek like replicator, then Starbucks can start to worry.
Yes,
because it's the same. It would be the same sort of thing, right? I can get my coffee digitally.
I can get my coffee digitally and at home. Why would I get out of my lounge pants in the middle of a pandemic to go? Oh wait.
Yes. So, you had not moved down here. You moved down here after this had happened, but when GameStop purchased EB in Livingston Mall, which is about 10 minutes from our house, you could go to EB Games on the bottom floor and GameStop on the top floor. Now, after GameStop purchased EB, there was an upstairs GameStop and a downstairs GameStop, and the mall's not that big.
No, mall's pretty tiny.
They eventually closed the downstairs GameStop.
Right, I think they put in like a Claire's or something.
Yeah. So, this year on their earnings call, as reported by Gamasutra, who was listening to the call, GameStop is planning to close a net 320 stores. So in 2 years, they're looking to close 640 stores. Now, what's interesting about that is we know they've been aggressively reviewing their real estate deals, their leases.
Do we know how many stores they have in total? Is that public knowledge?
You know what? I used to get those emails when I worked for Game Informer that they would say, hey, we opened this many stores, we closed this many stores, here are the stores that are going to close. I don't remember off the top of my head. I'm sure that information can be found. It's not super secret.
If we can find it, we'll post it in the show notes.
Absolutely. The other thing I noticed that their balance sheet, they have about $500 million in the bank now. That's down from $1.62 billion at the end of last fiscal year. That number was high, though, and we think that was probably due to the sale of Spring Mobile, I think, was last year.
I think so, yeah. They were starting to sell off some of their weirder subsidiaries. That was a weird one.
The things, the way they tried to plug the hole, and
was with mobile gaming.
Or with selling used devices, right? Taking trade-ins on your old iPhone.
Well, but that's the same thing. That's capitalizing on mobile gaming. Mm-hmm. If we really think about it, if we drill down to what the trend there was and continues to be, people play mobile games. They need devices to play their mobile games on. And if you can get your iPhone for a little bit cheaper from a place that you're already going to buy your new console from, I mean, why not? But the problem is that why would I trust GameStop for a phone?
Right. And I think you're right, though. I think you hit on the thing that if people are going into window shop, oh, they also do this, but how many people are going into GameStop to browse?
These days, probably nobody. I know that this is all anecdotal, but my brother and I, when we were in our early 20s, I mean, we would go wander around GameStop. Well, in Canada, it's EB Games. But we would go wander around just to see what's what. And this was before I worked in the industry. So, I mean, we were in the mall, we had our Orange Julius. I mean, it was right across from Orange Julius, so why not?
When I lived in Rochester, New York, they opened up a GameStop about 2 minutes from my house right next to the supermarket that I used to shop at.
Well, and that's another reason for you to be like, I'm just going to go mosey on into GameStop.
And I think that a lot of our listeners have probably had this experience. There are good GameStops and not so good GameStops. And if you have a good GameStop with a good manager and a good assistant manager and good staff, like, that's wonderful for a gamer. And I used to go in just to hang out.
Yeah. And
like, I used to go in to just say hi.
Absolutely. And the EB Games that was in Kamloops, my hometown in British Columbia, they had a great staff when I was a teenager and up until I left my hometown and I moved to Vancouver. It was really hard for me to find a good EB Games in Van, but Steven and I just kind of made do. And that was like our weird little mall rat hangout spot.
So the last thing I want to hit on the financials, and then I want to talk just very briefly about how revisit, because I think we talked about this last week with somebody. I can't remember which episode we talked about GameStop and how it was we talked about it on a number of podcasts because they didn't close down and they weren't treating the staff right.
We talked about it with Brandon, mm-hmm. and we talked about it with Matt.
Right.
I don't know if we talked about it with any... I don't think we talked to... We might have talked to Victoria about it as well.
Right. So just the other thing I want to pull out from their earnings was their statement of cash flows. At the end of fiscal year 2019, their net cash flow was negative $414.5 million. Now, I went back and looked. End of fiscal year 2018, so this is reported in 2019, they had positive cash flows of $325.1 million. Fiscal 2017, positive cash flows of $434.9 million. Fiscal year 2016, $537.1 million. So we're seeing a decrease in cash flows.
But the decrease in cash flow was not nearly as significant as basically 100%
right
year over year losses, right?
Yes.
So
it's rough out there. Now, shifting to our current situation, the fact that those stores have had to close, and I wish they would treat their employees better. I wish that they were taking care of their people better.
Oh, absolutely. They owe their people so much, considering what they put them through on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Now, those stores being closed, the shift to digital is going to become more pronounced. Here's one for you. And I'm going to shift this just to film. We are behind a little bit. We like to have the Marvel movies on physical versions.
We do.
And I went to go look at how and when we could get them. Man, you just can't get shipments from Amazon and Best Buy, like finding them right now and going, even
well,
it's just rough.
I went to, I left the house. Everyone should be really shocked right now because I hadn't really left the house at all for like a week and a half because I'm not supposed to because I'm higher risk for COVID. But I went to Target because I needed to go pick up agave because we didn't have any at our supermarket.
If you've never had agave in your coffee, have some agave in your coffee.
All right. So Mike's changing his career to an agave salesperson. So that's really magical. But anyway, I needed to go pick up a few things from Target. I went inside. I actually went looking for some, for some new Blu-rays to bring home. I couldn't find anything of significance while I was there. I saw some cool like kids titles on DVD, but their Blu-ray section had clearly been picked over.
Yeah. So when we want to watch Captain Marvel again, we'll just, that one's on Disney Plus, but Spider-Man Far From Home is not.
That's on Netflix.
Is it?
Yes.
That explains why. Good.
How did we devolve this conversation into the movies we're watching?
I love Marvel stuff. So GameStop right now, I think what we're going to see is an acceleration of their challenges because they've had to close their stores. I don't think that they are going to do the online business that they think they're going to do.
They don't offer the discounts. They don't offer 2-day delivery or anything like that. And I mean, obviously no one is able to fulfill the prime deliveries on Amazon, but even getting stuff from Best Buy, I would rather purchase something from Best Buy and, run to the store to go pick it up from them to thank them in person and, whatever. That was prior to the pandemic, but these days they'll ship it to my house in about a week.
Mm-hmm. My final thought on this right now, and then if you have anything else you want to share on this before we move on to the next topic, is this. This generation, gaming has become an impulse purchase. We have enabled gaming to become an impulse purchase through digital delivery and through deep discounts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So retail as an impulse purchase, if you are out and about, or you are going to like specifically go somewhere because they have a used copy and you can get it cheaper, okay, great. Mm-hmm. But retail is no longer, it was never necessarily an impulse purchase, but digital makes impulse purchasing so much more realistic. And now, given our current situation, am I going to go out or am I just going to download it on PC or Xbox Live or the eShop or PlayStation Network? I'm going to forgo my usual, I'd rather have it physical, and I'm just going to buy it digitally.
Well, that's the interesting thing, right? Before I met you, I wasn't really stuck on digital versus physical. In the previous generation, I was. I was absolutely 100% of the time physical copies only because those shops were frustrating and I wouldn't be able to carry them forward. I knew I wouldn't be able to carry them forward. I think my only exception was maybe Tokyo Jungle.
Ugh. Can we just take a moment?
Let's take a moment for Tokyo Jungle. Let's think about Tokyo Jungle. If you don't know anything about Tokyo Jungle, go learn about Tokyo Jungle.
Sony, if anybody from Sony's listening to this.
Tokyo Jungle.
Can we please have Tokyo Jungle back? Can you just like re-release it?
Please. Don't have to do anything to it.
Just
give it to us.
As is.
We want it.
Just Tokyo Jungle.
Okay.
Okay, we're done.
All right, we're done with Tokyo Jungle.
Anything else on GameStop?
I don't think so. I think that your point about impulse buying is really important because, like I said, that used to be my weird mall rat hangout with my brother. And we would do, trade-ins and everything like that. Because back then, I was only trade-in. Mm-hmm. I would finish a game. I would trade it in. I would get a new game. I was broke all the time. I was a broke student. What did you want from my life? Like, I wasn't really an adult yet.
I just want to be able to. There is a game that I never purchased. And I regret it now because you can't get anywhere because it's a licensed game. So, I mean, yeah, I would, there's, there is there are still places where retail makes a lot of sense. And absolutely, where retail is
but
your option.
Big box retail makes a lot of sense, because if you're like I said, going to Target to go pick up something from their grocery section, or you're going to Best Buy because you need to go and pick up a new mouse or whatever, why not go and wander by their gaming section just to see what they have? But the difference is that it's like all of these experiences have changed drastically throughout the course of the last 10 years, where buying a game is no longer an experience. It's just something that you do quickly, you get out of there, and you're just like, peace out, bye.
Yeah.
Versus clicking a button on a website. So we could have an entire discussion about the changing, how the changing landscape of game consumption has really affected gaming as an experience, but we're not gonna,
because and what's great is that you have given us a perfect segue.
I did? Oh, yes. I didn't do it on purpose either.
So, yeah, we're talking about gaming consumption and how that's changed, which leads us into our next topic.
All right, so we're gonna talk about Sony. Mike, what's going on with Sony?
So, I would say that nothing that's different than what's going on with other providers. I think Sony's been really upfront about this.
Mm-hmm.
A couple days ago, I think it was 3 days ago, they issued a statement on how things were happening, what was going on in Europe.
Yes.
And CEO, president and CEO of Sony Interactive Entertainment, Jim Ryan, posted on the PlayStation blog that users in Europe may experience slower downloads as Sony does its part to preserve internet access for the community at large.
The folks especially that are working from home.
Absolutely. Now, we've talked in the past, and this was a conversation on Twitter about, oh, games are the thing that are going to jam up the internet. It's not the case. God.
You know what's jamming up the internet?
4K streaming of
Netflix.
Media. Yeah, Netflix and Amazon Prime and everything else. And, you know, there's data out there that shows how much bandwidth each of those things uses. Now, if you're playing an online game, you're not using that much bandwidth. If you're downloading games, though,
yes, you are using a significant amount of bandwidth depending on how big the game is. And if everybody's staying home, they're purchasing Doom Eternal, they're purchasing Animal Crossing, you know, they're getting these games that are bigger AAA games, those are a significant footprint.
Absolutely. So Sony then updated today, same thing in the US, they're probably going to be throttling download speeds. And they're working with ISPs, but it's all for the greater good. And this is an important point.
Exactly.
That people who are working from home, we know that our networks are taxed. If you have a regular medical appointment, like I had my pulmonologist called me today on FaceTime. He called me, hey, I'm just checking in with people. What kind of phone do you have? I have an iPhone. Great, I'll call you back on FaceTime in a minute. We had one of our kids they had a psychiatrist appointment today. That was done via Doxy. Therapists are using Doxy. And these networks are taxed because all of a sudden everything is moving virtual. Zoom is eating up a lot of bandwidth. And, you know, so you have networks that are being taxed. So I'm glad to hear that companies like Sony, Amazon, I believe, is throttling.
Netflix as well.
Netflix is throttling a little bit. So your quality is not going to be quite as good. And that's a bummer, which
but
is
also
why we buy all of our Marvel movies physical.
Do you really need to watch How I Met Your Mother in 4K?
No,
probably not.
But I do need to watch Endgame in 4K.
I'm not ready to rewatch Endgame yet. Yeah. I feel like my mental health cannot take that strain right now.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. I think I'd end up just sobbing in a corner inconsolably.
And the only other part of that Sony thing, as we sob inconsolably, and then cheer, and then sob. I love you, 3000.
Oh, why did you have to bring that out? Now I'm actually going to cry.
Because I'm a monster.
You are.
Sony says that it's still on track for all of its plans through the end of its fiscal year, which ends March 2021.
Yeah. We're going to start being able to have some of these conversations about fiscal quarters and year ends and everything like that within the next few weeks, I guess.
Yes. We are almost at the end of the fiscal year. They are still evaluating first party, so it's not out of the question that we might see some first-party delays. Bethesda just announced yesterday, I think it was, that its big Wastelanders update for Fallout 76 was delayed a week because, hey, people are transitioning to work from home. It's a different environment. It's tough.
Absolutely.
And we talked with Scott Hartzman last week about some of the challenges in the development side of things.
And it's solely on the development side of things because Live Ops, they're used to working remotely because it's an uptime of, mm-hmm. you know, as close to 100% as you can get with, you know, 24/7 access. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. You should definitely listen to that episode if you're curious about how live ops and live games work in concert with work from home. Like, they've been leading the charge on that for the last decade.
Yeah, absolutely. And our last topic for the day, our
big one.
This
is a biggie.
This is our big one. Epic Games has gotten into publishing and done it, and their first announcement is pretty huge. Before we start talking about that, though, one of the things that constantly gets confused online is this concept of Steam being a platform and Epic Games Store being a platform. And one of the things that I really caution people about is using that word to compare those two PC storefronts, but specifically to compare Epic or Steam to Xbox or to PlayStation or to yeah. Nintendo Switch. Amanda, can you talk a little bit about the difference between a storefront versus a platform? And yeah.
I can do you one better.
Great.
Let's talk about what a platform is and is not. A platform is the environment in which you are playing your game. We have an Xbox. Mm-hmm. An Xbox is the platform. The Xbox operating system runs the platform. We have a PlayStation. The PlayStation is a platform. We have a Nintendo Switch. The Switch is the platform. We have a PC. Actually, we have several PCs. Our PCs are the platform. The platform is PC. You have a Mac. The Mac is a platform.
I have a phone.
Your phone is a platform.
So I have an iPhone, but if somebody had an Android, that would be a different platform.
Absolutely. They're running different operating systems. So, and if you have a Linux box, that's a platform.
Mm-hmm.
However, what is not a platform is Steam. Steam is not a platform. Steam is a marketplace. It is a storefront. It has really cool social features. It's got a lot of quality of life things that we've come to love and appreciate over the, oh my God, 17 years that they've been around. Oh, has it really been 17 years?
Which was it launched with Half-Life 2?
Did it really?
Was it Half-Life 2 that launched with?
I don't remember.
I think it was Half-Life 2.
I think you might be right. But it's been around for a really, really long time. But Steam is still a storefront. It is not a platform unless it lived in its own box somewhere else.
And they tried that.
They did. It didn't work.
SteamOS is a platform.
Yes,
SteamOS. But Steam itself
is not.
It has platform-like features. Its social Correct. Features are platform-like.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's where people tend to get stuck, is that it has these platform-like features that we're used to seeing on Xbox and we're used to seeing on PlayStation and that we've come to really love and appreciate. I know that you and I speak with our partner James on Steam all the time when we're playing Final Fantasy XIV, which lives in its own launcher. But that's the thing, is that the PC marketplace is both unified and fragmented for all of its various launchers. And I think that that's where people tend to get either confused or annoyed or irritated or whatever, because it's like, why can't everything just be on one thing as opposed to being fragmented to all the other things? And then that's how they end up confusing Steam as a platform versus Steam as a marketplace.
Right. So why are we having this conversation?
We are having this conversation because we've had to have this conversation because of the Epic Game Store. We've had this conversation so much over the last
year,
12 months, 12 plus 12, months.
14.
Oh my months. Goodness.
Because it was at the Game Awards in December 2018 that EGS came on the scene big.
Correct. And that was in either at the tail end of November or the early December. It was early December. And so you're right. We have been talking about this for about 14 months and we've had to have that conversation about, okay, so conflating Steam as a platform versus Steam as a marketplace and the Epic Game Store as a platform, not a marketplace, is not helping.
It isn't. And I think that the reason why we have to have this conversation is people are really upset about timed exclusives on the Epic Games Store, which is a storefront, not a platform. And you're right, there is this big conflation.
Because they're upset that they're going to have a couple of different launchers that they don't like, that Epic has, you know, Epic's, one of Epic's biggest investors is Tencent, which is a Chinese media conglomerate. And, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there are tons and tons of different reasons that people have given you, that people have given me, for the reasons why they don't like it. And that's okay. Your preferences as a human being matter because they matter to you. And that is okay. And
if EGS doesn't have features that you like about Steam, it is okay for you to prefer playing on Steam. The harassment that has jumped out of that is not okay.
Agreed.
And that is the segue
into... Feelings good, reactions bad.
Yes, as we tell our children all the time.
Oh, dear.
Apropos of nothing. The reason why we're having this conversation is yesterday, Epic announced that it is fully getting into publishing. It announced that it has struck deals with three companies, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. But I really want to focus on the terms of the deals that have been disclosed to the public.
And they're numerous.
There are numerous. And I think it's important because there is that same vocal minority that is reacting strongly to Epic having any sort of arrangement with developers, which is mind-boggling to me. Just as a recap, here are things that we know. The revenue share when you're selling on EGS is 12% to Epic, 88% to the developer.
Yes.
Which is better than Steam's 70-30, which again has been tiered for the largest games to take advantage of, but smaller studios will never see that tier. Discord store, which came and it went, and that was 90-10. But Epic really kind of redefined the conversation with an 88-12 split. On top of it, we know for a fact, and this came out of the Ooblets post, that the deals that Epic is striking for timed exclusivity come in the form of guaranteed minimums. Now, a guaranteed minimum says, up to a certain point, if you sell 100,000 copies, let's say, even if you only sell 90,000 copies, we're going to pay you as if you sold 100,000 copies.
Which is enormous.
It is.
It's enormous because it helps the developers with their development costs. It helps them to get to market. It helps them to deal with all of the various costs that go along with making a game, which it includes things like quality assurance. It includes things like marketing and distribution and, in some cases, localization.
Exactly. But more importantly, I think, it helps with mental health. Because if you're not worried about your game making enough that your studio is going to survive the launch of your game, you are in a better mental place, you're going to be doing your work in a way that is a little bit lower stress, and you know for a fact, you can start thinking it's okay to let those creative wheels turn a little bit on what your next thing is without having to worry, am I actually going to be able to make this next thing?
The interesting comparison that we can make here is in first-party exclusives. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about this in terms of, like, I just finished publishing a piece on Inverse about God of War and how God of War, the latest installment in God of War for PlayStation 4, why they were able to take the creative risks that they were able to take. They are a first-party studio. They are owned by Sony. They are there to sell consoles. It's not a one-to-one comparison here, but they didn't have to worry about the game selling. All their stuff is already paid for. The studio's going to stay open no matter what. The function of the game has already been laid out. They were able to take risks, and those risks were richly rewarded.
Absolutely. So here's what we know about the deals that Epic is making with developers.
So one of the deals that they are making with developers is that this is not just about PC games. And up until recently, all we were seeing from the Epic Game Store is a PC storefront, so it was very much so geared toward PC games. The great thing about this is that these are multi-platform. So we are going to see these kinds of games in a number of different places.
Sure. We're going to see them. We know for a fact we're going to see them on Xbox Series X. We're going to see them on PlayStation 5. We may see them on Switch. But we're going to see them on PC. I think the big question mark right now is, on PC, are these going to be timed exclusives on EGS? I would expect that. If they're not, great, but...
I would expect that too, but Tim Sweeney, who's the CEO at Epic Games, is very pro-developer. What he cares about is getting developers the money they need to make the experiences that they've always wanted to make and to get the money out of the way. That's the important part here, is that... And that's another really interesting piece of this this publishing puzzle is that it's up to 100% of funding is going to come from the Epic Games publishing. Can you expand on that?
Sure. So when we talk about funding a game, We talk about it in terms of two different broad categories of costs. We talk about the development costs. That's keeping your studio open, your overhead, paying your people, buying, you know, paying for your licenses, your assets, your contractors, everything that goes into making the game. Then on the other side of things, there's go-to-market costs. And this is the stuff that people often forget when they're pitching. We've been looking at a lot of pitches for
developers. We really have.
So one of those things, and you listed off a bunch of them.
I did.
So QA, quality assurance, is one. Who is going to be responsible for paying for QA? In this case, Epic's going to pay for it in most cases. They unless there's an arrangement with the developer where they have internal QA where they can get that managed.
Sure.
Or a combination of internal, external.
But I mean, look at the amount of people that work at Epic Games that work in QA, and they're mm-hmm. already some of the best QA people in the industry.
Sure. And that's probably a combination of leveraging internal at the studio, internal at Epic, and then contracting out with reputable QA shops, right?
And there are a number of them. Sorry.
Absolutely. Localization is another one. And a lot of times we talk to developers who haven't considered localization costs. Now, if they're in North America, chances are they're probably only thinking about English. But a lot of times...
But if you want to distribute in Canada, it has to be in English and in French.
And if you want to go to Europe, chances are FIGS is a term you'll hear. So that's French, Italian, German, and Spanish.
Agreed.
So you'll have FIGS, you'll have English, right? So those will be your core languages. And then, depending on the relationship and depending on who the studio is, localization in other languages. And in fact, one of the studios is a Japanese studio. So chances Brilliant. Are you're going to see a variety of Asian languages that are going to be involved in that localization process. Marketing is involved. Distribution. First party relations and who's responsible for paying to get the or managing getting your pages up on all of the different storefronts. And that is a larger effort than you might think it is.
It's a really involved process. Those cogs, they be complicated.
Yep. And we talk a little bit about that in the Game Dev Business Handbook, which is my first book about what it takes to get a page up on one of those stores.
Now, one of the things that I noticed that we're not necessarily talking about is we're not talking about public relations. Is that something that you think that Epic will be helping them to manage as a publisher?
I think that's the et cetera. I don't know if Epic will manage it themselves necessarily, but
or they'll help they them might make allow connections. Content.
Yeah, so they will pay for it, whatever Got shape it. That takes. I think that's grouped into marketing. I think the other thing that's grouped into marketing that people don't often consider is that when you have a deal with a publisher, usually what happens is you have your development costs and then anything in excess of that is agreed upon as part of the contract. So if let's say your development budget is $500,000 and your publisher is paying for that, your recoup, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second, could end up being closer to $600,000 or $700,000, depending on your marketing costs, your QA, your localization, all of that stuff. And marketing includes travel, lodging, per diem, when you go to shows, because, well, yeah. Before this, you went to shows to show off your game.
That reminds me of our conversation with Victoria.
Yes.
She misses going to shows, but not really.
So let's talk a little bit about recoup.
All right. So this is the really big one. This is the one that I am super thrilled about. Epic Games Publishing is agreeing to a 50-50 revenue split after recoup. Mike, why is this so important?
So I think people don't quite understand how good a 50-50 split is. A lot of times, especially if you're a new developer, you're signing with a publisher the first time, it might be a 70-30 recoup for the life of the sales.
Yeah.
With 100% recoup before you recognize any revenue for your studio.
Yeah.
Now, this is why we counsel people to include in a budget post-launch, because you're not going to see that money. You're not going to start seeing revenue share until after your game reaches $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 in sales, if that was your budget plus the extras on top of it.
Sure.
And then you're only getting 30% of the net. Now, we talked about this, I think, with Scott last week. Where... You know, those deals are structured. What does it mean
yes.
To be 30% of the net? Now, that could be, it's likely going to be after platform fees. So yeah. On EGS, that would be after 12%. On Steam, that's after 30%. On Xbox, that's after 30%. So you immediately
30%
are taking...
30% is, for the most part, pretty market standard.
Right, with the exception of EGS.
Yes.
So immediately your net is your sales price minus 30%. So you start to see how this gets whittled down. We had a question... last week about how much of a...
That was when we were talking to Matt.
Right. Yeah. So it was when we were talking to Matt. And
The question was about how much money does a developer make on a sale, and on any given sale.
And the answer is it depends, but it all depends on how that's defined. But 70-30 is not uncommon. Now, some of that is tiered, where after a certain amount of sales post-recoup, that changes to maybe 60-40. And mind you, that lower amount is to the developer. So the 70 goes to the publisher, because they're the ones taking the risk.
They are taking the financial risk, and they're the ones that are footing the bill.
Mm-hmm. And the developer will see 30%, 40%, but 50-50... Man, that is a great deal.
That's an amazing deal, especially for new developers that have never entered. They don't have any necessarily any games that are on the market yet. They don't have a track record. They may not have a reputation. Maybe some of their developers, some of their key figures do. But if the studio itself is unproven, you are not likely to see this kind of a deal from anyone else. It is so indicative of Sweeney's dedication to developers.
Now, there's only one other deal I know of that is better than this, and I don't know the terms around that deal, so I can't say, like, point blank, like, oh, one's a better deal than the other. But in terms of revenue share, EA Originals is post-recoup 100% to the developer.
That's true.
Now, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay, but what is EA Originals for those of us that don't necessarily know about EA's program?
These are very small projects. So Sea of Solitude was one. The original Unravel was one.
Unravel 2 was also...
Was it an EA Originals project?
I think it was an EA Originals project.
So again, these are relatively small budget projects. They fulfill EA's commitment to indie developers, and they sign really interesting games. I would say
they're
that every...
almost art house games. Yeah. Like, Sea of Solitude was definitely an art house game.
So, I like the EA Originals program, but I don't know all of the other terms around it, so I can't... I wouldn't... There are so many pieces of deals that it's hard to say this one deal is the best deal versus this one's the best deal. I would say it's a good deal. Right.
Yeah, exactly. We don't actually know what goes into the fine print of any of these deals at the end of the day. All we can do is speculate based on information that we've gathered over the years from conversations that we've had from industry experts.
And now here's some of the fine print on the Epic deals.
Absolutely. Let's get into
full creative control to the developer. So Epic is not going to, as the publisher, is not going to meddle. They're not going to say, oh, can you do this thing to monetize it more? As we sometimes hear people afraid that a publisher is going to say to a developer and therefore impact the design.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean like in that very famous case from a handful of years ago, less than a handful of years ago? That we talked to the person that wrote stuff.
That one. And we don't know where that impetus was coming from.
We really don't. So we can't actually speculate on it, but we're pretty sure it came from something on high.
Yes. With mouse ears.
Wow. Can we say that?
Yes. the other big thing here is that Epic is allowing the developers to retain the IP. So if you see a 50-50 deal, if any other publisher is offering a 50-50 deal, chances are the publisher is going to say, okay, but we get to own the IP. Now, what we don't know, and this is where there's some white space around this where we need to be a little bit cautious, because it could be that Epic says, well, we get first right of refusal on the second game, if you want to do another game. Or it could be that Epic retains the merchandising rights or other things. Now, I'm not saying that for sure. Those things are not uncommon in contracts. But the fact that that the devs get to retain IP, the question is what kind of walls are then around that IP. Based on the rest of this, I'm going to guess not a lot. That this might
basically
be an outright...
Basically a pony wall.
Yeah, exactly. a conversation. Again, we can't really speculate on that. It's just important to note that just because a developer retains control of their IP doesn't mean there aren't conditions around that. So it's important that we mention that. But in general, these are really, really good deals. And they've signed them with some really, really great studios.
They really have. So one of the big, big wins for them is Remedy.
I would say that's a big win for me as a huge, huge Remedy fan.
I'm sorry, for both of us. Let's be real. We're both huge Remedy fans. We both loved Control and Quantum Break. We're enormous Alan Wake fans.
Yeah, I'm super excited for that second piece of Control DLC.
Absolutely. So they also ended up partnering with Playdead, which is amazing. I loved Limbo. Inside was, I think, my indie game of the year when it came out. Back when I was writing consumer coverage. I love Playdead. Those are some really messed up people working there, but in the best way.
And then the last one they signed was with Gen Design, which is the team led by Fumito Ueda, who brought us The Last Guardian and Ika.
And Shadow of the Colossus.
So super excited to see where that project goes. Epic has also said that there are going to be additional partners announced in the coming months, as well as additional details on this game. The one thing we do know about the Remedy things, and I think Remedy said this was before, it was earlier in the day yesterday, I think it was, before Epic announced. They came out and said, we're not going to tell you who the publisher is yet, but we have a new IP and two new games coming in that IP. I think one is going to be large and one was going to be small, if I recall. So,
I mean, given Remedy's track record of creating bonkers narrative games that have weird, it's like they're the weird science of video games.
Mm-hmm. They are. Look, Sam's a great guy. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him a number of times. The one that sticks out in my mind was Gamescom. It was when Jack Joyce still wasn't Sean, when Sean Ashmore hadn't been cast yet, and it was still like the template Jack Joyce in the trailer, but he was wearing a Nightfalls t-shirt.
Oh shoot, I forgot about that.
So I asked when Oz was working there, I asked him after the press session at Gamescom, I'm like, he was wearing a Nightfalls t-shirt, like what's the deal? He's like, well, okay, so between us, which you can report, Sam has this vision that all of his games exist in the same universe. Now, we saw some of that with Alan Wake.
Yes.
Because there was the whole Max Payne connection.
Yes.
Right? And then there were some hints in Quantum Break that there was other stuff going on. But when they announced the DLC for Control, and the second one was AWE, and they showed, like, the top half of that key art is Alan Wake. Like, it was embarrassing how like giddy I was here in the office. I'm like, what?
Yeah, there was some like internal and external screaming about this. There was shouting, much like I do on the Engaged Family podcast. Just lots of shouting.
Yeah. So I'm really excited for all of those. I'm excited to see who else they've signed with. Hopefully that gives a little bit more clarity around what deals typically look like and why those in the development community have been lauding Epic and pretty happy about this, because I saw one headline, and I think that this is a pretty accurate depiction of what's going on. Epic took on Steam with the Epic Game Store. Now it's taking on the entire publishing community with these kind of deals. It's setting a new standard. Now, not everybody's going to be able to get one of these deals, but hopefully this nudges things a little bit.
Well, that's the thing, is that it would be great to see more of these kinds of deals in the future, especially from publishers that can take that kind of risk. And they're signing developers that are doing interesting, weird, beautiful things with video games.
Our guest today is Ava Carr, founder of Glitch, an indie label that has published Hyperdot and Optica.
Thank you for joining us, Ava.
All right, well, let's go grab
Ava. Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to talk to you all today.
And we're super excited to have you.
All right, so why don't we just jump right into it, Mike?
Absolutely. Ava, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and your origin story in gaming?
Oh, gosh. I started in games roughly about 10 years ago. I've been working in the industry in various roles doing, things like systems design, business development, and then also publishing for companies like Activision, Blizzard Media Networks, and Riot. More recently, I had started my own company and opened up specifically an indie publishing label. And we've been doing that for a couple of years now. I think we're on year three.
That's excellent.
That's really wonderful. So what is, I know that this isn't on the list of questions that I sent you, but obviously I'm just gonna like popcorn and ask questions.
Let's do it.
Follow-up questions. Tell me about some of the inspiration that was behind founding your indie publishing label. Like, why did you open Glitch?
I can't believe, I'm gonna go back for quite some time, which is I was actually in college at the University of Minnesota when the idea of Glitch really started. I started a student group at the University of Minnesota, and the reason that I had started it was initially because I wanted to know a little bit more about how to get in the industry. I wanted to know a lot more about like what it means to work on and either, you know, work on games or work alongside games. I got really excited after a little while of like, I got really excited because I got back into StarCraft. Really, that's what it started.
That's fair.
When I was younger, I played and made a lot of like games online, like battle simulators and AOL chat rooms and websites to build my Beanie Babies. But then my parents had like a very specific idea as to who I should be and what my career should be. Mm. I'm Thai and they're very Asian. So I had like two roles that I could play, which was either I was going to become a doctor or I was going to become a lawyer. And during college, I realized that, you know, there was a YouTube video that popped up and it was like, you know, a Korean game based in, like, it was just a game, a pro league game with a player, a Zerg player that I really loved back in the day named Jadong. And, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, games, like, I need to figure out how to get back into this. I started Glitch in its like nascent form as a student group. And what that really ended up doing was we launched a bunch of different programs, started getting a lot of people from the industry involved in doing like talks and flying them out for conferences and conventions that we would host at the university. And I did that for really just like a couple of years. I was 19 at the time, and the first few months we saw a huge influx of people that were super interested. Really, you know, our listserv list grew to roughly about like 2,000 or 3,000 people in the first couple of months. So I took that information and went to the university and was like, hey, you know, like there's an appetite for this and I'd like money in order to be able to continue to do this. And I want to see what this really means and what this is, because for me, like my goals at the time was just to learn and to connect with other people who were interested in the same things. And that's really how it all got started. That's how I got introduced to a lot of people who were in the games industry. And that's how, you know, from college, I took a stint and, you know, went in the AAA route for a little while and decided that it was, it made more sense for me to figure out how to work in games my own way. And I realized that, you know, at the end of the day, what drives me and one of my biggest motivations was recognizing that, you know, I felt very alone for some reason. And after doing a lot of research, I started recognizing that, like, specifically with creative leadership and also with foundership, like, I thought that I was just weird and I thought that I was just different, but I recognized after reading a couple of reports from like the IGDA and a couple of reports from oh my gosh, why can't I think of the name of the organization right now?
It's Friday.
A research organization. Yeah, it's a research organization. I don't remember right now. I put a couple of statistics together and recognize that, you know, less than 1% of all founders and C-suite executives in the games industry are actually women and people of color. And so I started really recognizing that, you know, a lot of folks are like me or think like me or, you know, do this type of work in a leadership role are, you know, absent at the decision-making level. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've been really passionate about and something that I've really taken to heart with what we're doing right now at Glitch and what we're doing moving forward as well with the next stage of the organization.
And I think as we look towards next stages in general, our current situation has really impacted things.
Especially in the indie space.
Especially in the indie space. What are some of the challenges that indies are specifically facing as a result of the widespread stay-at-home orders that aren't just, you know, local in our country, but global at this point?
Yeah, so when talking to, you know, the folks that we work with and our network of developers, there are a couple of things that come, like, that rise straight to the top. And I think one of the biggest things is people rely so heavily on live events for, especially, like, publishing deals and to connect with community, to meet their players face-to-face, to do press. And I think right now that is one of the biggest things, if not, you know, it's one of the biggest things for sure, is what does life look like as a founder and a creative leader in, you know, an indie company do in this world without live events? And how are they going to adapt? And that's something that we've been talking a lot, again, with our founders that we're working with, and even through some of our programs like Power Leveling, which is a mentorship program that we usually have at GDC again, founders in games. And it's just kind of like, gosh, what do people do, and how can people be effective in pitching, finding their community, engaging with players in a way, and also engaging with press in a way that can simulate, or not replicate, but definitely like simulate a conference or a convention experience, because that face-to-face time is just so important.
Yeah, that was one of the conversations that we had last week with Steph Tinsley, is that a lot of what happens in this industry, that people have a tendency to be like, oh, well, we don't need live events. I mean, they're not that important. No, they're extremely important, especially for indie developers and especially for press, for us to be able to get FaceTime with one another, for those chance encounters, those conversations in hallways that lead to bigger stories, for panels like the one that we had at PAX West a couple of years ago, where you and I met for the first time.
Yes.
You know, our love letters to the industry. God, what a great, that was so great. I think that was the first time I met Corey as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Barlog,
yeah. Oh my goodness. What a wonderful panel that was. But that kind of, that leads us into our next question is, you know, how might our current environment shape the indie community in both the near and the distant future? What kinds of ripples are we going to see for indies in general?
I think that's a really tough question. I know for me, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is how can we continue to, how can we actually facilitate and foster some of those conversations online that feels good, that feels, you know, we can do all of this online. We've had conversations, you know, we have had guilds of,
sure,
we play games together online, and we, I think, are probably the most adept community to this. But how can we make that magic, and how can we figure out how to add that, like, those moments and have those online? I don't fully know what the answers are, but I know that for us, like, we are doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on Discord and figuring out exactly how we're going to do things like online playtesting that we usually work with, you know, indie developers. Like, people will, when we had it at our office, what people would do would just be like, oh, they show up with games, we invite the public to come out and playtest, we made like an event essentially around it, and our whole team, like our community dads and a couple of other folks on the team, have been talking about like, how do we actually do that online, like with GDC, with Power Leveling, and the mentorship programs that we do for founders. You know, how exactly do we have that type of mentorship feeling, and then also some of those, even like the kind of chance encounters, but like they're very intentional chance encounters.
Yeah. Where,
like, how can you help people have that type of experience in a Discord or in like an online environment? How do we do that? Because I know, like, I was so bummed when I had to talk to, you know, our partners at, like, Microsoft and the Knight Foundation saying, like, you know, power leveling isn't going to be able to happen this year in this way. And the first questions are, like, how can we support this online?
That's
how
great.
Can we support it in a way that is different? And how can we think about this differently? So I think that's one thing. Is we're going to see a huge shift in the way that we do business, probably more so online, because I think COVID's probably going to last for like this quarantine's going to last, and I know our team is you know, in the long haul for roughly about the 6 month point.
Yep. That's what we're anticipating as well on our end.
Yeah, and so like we have to be able to figure out how to continue to have those conversations, those business meetings, and continue to feel connected while we're apart. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're going to see some really weird, interesting things that come along in the way of events. I think some of like the mentorship programs, we're going to see a lot of really interesting, weird things too. And I also think, for example, maybe the Steam Festival came in at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
At first, when I saw it, I was like, this is exactly, I'd rather do this at a PAX, or I'd rather do this at GDC. And now I'm kind of like, okay, this is coming at a good time. And that's really intriguing and interesting.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that. We've been trying to do indie spotlights on the show where mm-hmm. we have smaller developers, especially those who are impacted by GDC and E3 cancellation.
Mm-hmm. And PAX, quite frankly. We're not canceled yet, but we're anticipating, if nothing else, a delay.
But we have them talk a little bit about their projects. And yesterday's show, we had Broken Arms Games, their studio in Italy. They are working on a winemaking simulator called 100 Days. And they were part of the Steam Game Festival, and they talked about all the impacts that they have seen metric-wise from being part of that. So yeah, more events like that, especially ones that are on highly visible platforms, featuring games that typically might not get the spotlight, and being promoted by people like Jeff Keighley, who have a huge audience. That combination of factors seems to have worked really well.
Yes, absolutely. So I completely and entirely agree with you, and I believe we're going to see significantly more of that. And I think also something that I've noticed and I really love is, and something that we're thinking about too, is how can we support especially indie founders during this time of such uncertainty? Is it, you know, the biggest things that I've seen so far when people, like when I talk to people, there are four big things. One, they're concerned about funding and fundraising. Is funding drying up? Is that a thing? You know, is it that like folks are doing layoffs at the publishing level, at the platform level? Or like people are definitely concerned about where checks are going to be written from so that they can continue to make not only games, but also continue to live. So that's something that is another trend that I've really noticed, which is of concern for folks. And then the next thing too is, you know, things that are as small as like just paying rent, like what resources out there are there, you know, when a lot of indie studios, if you're not a distributed team, how, like, you're paying rent for a space that you're not staying in. If you're a smallish team that you, like, if you don't own your physical space or anything of sorts, like, you're currently paying, you know, a couple thousand dollars a month on a rental that you're not using. And so I've seen, at least on the housing side, people call for housing relief. And I'm starting to see rumblings of people feeling concerned about their overall rent because, you know, funding is currently tight. And if indie founders are concerned about, you know, where their money is going, it definitely sure as hell shouldn't be on a building or, you know, a studio space. And so there's been definitely rumblings around that, and I have a feeling there's going to be some sort of call for like a united front on figuring out how to, you know, go on a freeze. And I don't know if that's just within our community even, but maybe a whole, like a creative industry as a whole.
Yeah, I think it's going to be far and wide. And we've talked a number of times on the show about the ripple effect of this. And, you know, the game industry wasn't fully insulated in 2008 when we had the housing crisis.
But it was a later ripple.
Right, it definitely was a later ripple. And you didn't see furloughs and layoffs happen in a way that you did in other industries, for instance. Yeah. Now, we're feeling it right now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, everybody is feeling it. There is, unless you're Blue Apron, right, who has seen their stock, like, jump, everybody is feeling this. And it's, you know, we talk about it as a ripple, and I'm starting to think of it more like dominoes falling, right?
It does
one thing
like
happens,
that.
Knocks the next thing down, or knocks the next thing down, or knocks the next thing down, and it's going to touch everything. And it's not just one domino. Your domino doesn't just knock over one, everything branches.
So, I think that that's really interesting. And this is a question I'm dying to ask, Ava. How do you think our current circumstances are going to force everyone, not just indies, but everyone in the game industry to innovate on the way that they do business?
I think that's a super interesting question. you know, first and foremost, the biggest thing is everything is going to live online in some capacity, and that's 100% true. I think in general, I'm trying to think of it from like my perspective as the founder of Glitch. You know, one of the biggest concerns that I've had is, you know, how does, again, it comes back to like funding. How is our funding impacted when our funders have, you know, endowments or anything that's specifically related to the stock market? And I don't have the answer quite yet, and I'm still going through all of the motions of like trying to figure out, you know, what types of assistances are there, what types of you know, fellowships are there, or relief funding and such like that, not only for our partners, but like even just thinking about it, is this something that we should be thinking of? So I think there's going to be a lot more. I know one of the biggest things is that we're going to really, really need to start organizing. And I'm starting to see, again, just like with, you know, the relief fund, like the GDC relief fund. I know Rami has been doing so many things.
Definitely.
You know, like the disaster jam. Like we're going to need to organize more so than ever, especially as, you know, indie founders, to figure out how we can help each other and what are the biggest themes across all of us, so that we can not only just share resources, but also share just general information. And to be honest, just be there for each other. You know, like I have been in so many calls at this point with so many different founders, just like talking about anything from, you know, just business to life to playing Animal Crossing.
That's all we really want to talk about these days. Like even me and Mike, that's just Animal Crossing forever.
I know. Myself and like a couple of founders were just, you know, in a Animal Crossing like star. Like, we were all wishing upon stars together.
Oh, we did that on Amanda's
like, what are you wishing
time.
For? Yeah, what are you wishing for? What am I wishing for? Right? Like, I think we just need to figure out how to come together. And so a lot of the things that, again, that we've been really thinking about is like how can we take part in that role, especially with some of our upcoming projects, and really help to lead in that conversation, very specifically for like our community of what we consider, you know, founders of and in games in particular, bold new voices and big ideas in play. So like, that's the first thing that needs to happen, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And then the second thing is getting all of our partners involved. And when I say partners, I mean, you know, like whether it's PlayStation or Nintendo or all of our platform partners, all of the folks who are in media, and just talking to them. And you know, they're going through very similar things, but differently. And coming up with solutions together is always better than coming up with solutions apart.
That's fair.
And so I think those are at least like the first two steps. And for folks who are, you know, whether they're publishers or they're platforms, like I think on, you know, as you mentioned earlier, or as you mentioned before, with like Epic and such, and all of these folks who do have funding that is available, keeping an open line of communication with them to talk to them about like, what does their funding look like and how is it impacted, and how should you be preparing as a business for these changes. And I think opening up those conversations and being able to be vulnerable and saying like, this has impacted us a lot, we have some concerns here. So it's like those three stages of communication almost in organizing of amongst each other and other founders, amongst all of the founders and then all of their partners. And when I say partners, I mean like press, media, et cetera.
Sure.
And then also funding and their funders. So I know I've had so many of those, and each one is very challenging in their own way, and they're very stressful in their own way because there's so much information coming from, you know, developers, platforms, media, and, you know, everything, that the last thing is don't forget to care for yourself and to step away from it. I think those are going to be the, and I think that that's going to be the biggest change and the biggest impact is actually maybe for the better of more conversation and more collaboration about how to come up with solutions together.
I love it. Ava, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yes, this was a wonderful conversation. I love that you answered our last question without us needing to ask it.
Yeah, you segued yourself, and it was like,
it's magic.
Just sat back and listened, because it was that was an excellent answer. Not just the fact that you read our minds, but I just love what you had to say. Everything
Thank
there.
You.
You know, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that this industry is going to survive this and hopefully thrive. This is such a weird year for this to be happening on top of everything.
Yes, I completely agree.
And if we're going to do it, we're going to do it together. Because nobody is coming out of this unscathed.
Absolutely. I almost feel a little weird saying this, but I was like, there's a part of me that is excited to see what we come up with, because I know that, you know, being in games for so long, we're always ahead of the curve.
Yes.
In terms of technology and play and interaction and, you know, like, we're always ahead of the curve. And I'm very curious what it's going to look like with the solutions that we come up with in this world when, you know, we don't have live events and when we don't get to see each other face to face in the same ways that we used to sometimes. I'm very excited, and I actually felt like it was kind of a challenge that was placed on our team to figure out exactly how we would, you know, what I keep saying is, how are we going to still stay and feel connected while we're apart? And how do we keep that magic going when it's me now just playing the game at my desk alone, or with, you know, our team online, and a developer isn't just in front of us. And they have their charm and they can talk to us about, you know, some of their logic. It's going to be different, and I'm still excited for it, though.
I'm excited to see the kinds of innovations and creative solutions that the indie community comes up with as a result of all of this, because you're absolutely right. Indies are on the forefront of innovation in gaming. They always have been. And if anyone can help shine a bright, beautiful light on what the future could be, it's indies.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, and I feel weird saying that I'm excited to see what creative solutions we come up with to
stay connected. Being hopeful in this moment, not a bad thing.
I think that's a really wonderful thing, and I think that's a great thing for us to end on, and for our call to action for indies, more indies.
Yes. For those of you who listen to the show, you know we try to do an indie spotlight as often as we can. We've had one on most of the shows that we've done, not all, but most.
Most of them, yes.
And if you are an indie developer or an indie publisher, and you'd like a game that you are working on spotlighted on the show, please reach out to us via DM at VirtualEconCast on Twitter, or send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
We have some really interesting guests coming up next week as well. We're going to be settling into a different rhythm next week, like we were talking about when we were during our last episode with Walt. We're moving into two shows a week.
Yes.
Starting next week, because while we did an episode a day last week, it might have kind of...
It was a lot.
Yeah,
but we wanted to hit the ground running. We wanted to make sure you had plenty of things to listen to.
Exactly. These are the kinds of conversations that we wish we were having in person, that we wish we were writing about, and that we wish we were just, like, screaming to each other across rooms at E3 and at GDC, but we have a podcast now. So next week, we have the meme king himself, Dave Oshry of New Blood Interactive. He's going to come hang out with us, even though he's 17 hours ahead.
Yes. That's we figured out how to make it work.
We did.
Yeah.
We're going to do it live.
Absolutely. And next week, we will be speaking with Emily Rose from Rebind.io. We were supposed to speak to her this week. Schedules got a little messed up. But we are working on nailing down exactly when that's going to be. And we're even planning shows out for the week after that. But we'll tell you about those
next week. So thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. This has been episode 7.
I
think it's episode 7.
It is.
You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconCast. I'm at Amanda Farrow.
And I'm at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
Ava, where can people find you online?
I'm mostly on Twitter, so you can find me online at Ava, EVVA, Carr, KARR. And yeah, I'll be there tweeting things.
And Glitch has a Twitter account also, right?
Yeah. So, if you want to check out Glitch, we're at Hey Glitch. So HEYGLITCH.
Excellent. And you can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. Please review the show if you're listening on somewhere where you can do that. But most importantly, please subscribe. Subscribing to our show tells the algorithm gods that we are worth paying attention to.
And maybe they'll boost us.
Maybe they'll boost us.
Maybe they'll like us back. You can also DM us with questions at @VirtualEconCast on Twitter. Our DMs are open. Or you can send them to podcast@fsquared.biz. We will be back next week.
Yes. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you next week.